Man's hands, building his home, raising a flag, petting a dog, burning a flag. A man's hands, hiding his face, saying goodbye, making two fists, pointing up high. A man's hands, shaking his friend's hand, saving a life, digging a grave, picking tomatoes. A man's hands, holding his son, aiming a gun, teasing a woman, killing a man. A man's hands, over his head, folded in prayer, shackled in shame, nailed on a cross. God motivates them, the devil takes them, the hands of a man. The hands of a man.
Du weißt ja nicht, wie ich dich liebe. Du weißt ja nicht, wie ich dich mag. Geheimnis wissen, was du nie gehört zuvor. Oh, oh, Lehre, lass mich flüstern in dein Ohr. Diese Worte gehen vor. Ich hab dich so lieb. Höre, willst du ein Geheimnis wissen? Nie gehört zuvor. Oh, oh, nee, ja. Lass mich flüstern in dein Ohr. Diese Worte gehen vor. Ich hab dich so lieb. Hab das Geheimnis mit dabei, das niemand weiß, nur wir zwei. Wissen, was du nie gehört zuvor. Näher, lass mich flüstern in dein Ohr. Diese Worte gehen vor. Ich hab dich so lieb.
Self-appointed, self-righteous, self-opinionated, censorious do-gooders, do me a favor. Keep your scissors in your sewing basket, your bustles out of the bookstores, your mitts off the magazines, your mind out of the movies, and your dogma away from my door. Truthfully, do the words filthy, smut, and obscene describe what you read and view, or does it describe your mind? Where do you get your sanctimonious convictions? It is up to you what other people read or see. You have every right to control what your children read or see, just as I do. However, I do not appreciate your attempting to regulate what I or my children read or see. Because if I allow you to censor obscenity on your judgment, when do you begin screening the truth to conform with your beliefs? I'm not speaking of hardcore pornography. With proper sex education and home environment for our children, there wouldn't be the market there is now for pornography. We can only hope, with the so-called sexual revolution, the level-headed, truth-seeking youth of today will put the pious, self-appointed arbitrator of our moral objectives on the bookshelf in the history section. We hear you scream when there's a movie on television, if a scene or its theme is audacious to your maladjusted moral code. You profess to fear for the harm it could do your children. Most of the television sets I have seen have a knob that changes channels, and even one to turn it off. You are, however, strangely silent when a documentary of television demonstrates violence and brutality. We hear you scream when a movie contains nudity. You are strangely silent when a movie depicts the St. Valentine's Day massacre. If a scene displays more than a glimpse of a lady's breast, it must be cut. Yet a matinee of murder, mayhem, man's inhumanity to man makes a great substitute for a babysitter. You drive great literary works under the counter, yet buy monster comics for the kids by the armful. A toy manufacturer planned to introduce a boy doll complete with sex organs. I assume this would help teach children at the proper age that boys aren't just girls with muscles. Not to the muckrakers of America. They say the doll is obscene. Yes, Virginia, there is a sickness. Realizing you censorites believe you are saving humanity, consider this suggestion. The next time you feel the urge, fly down to the newsstand and confiscate all the gardening publications. Nobody digs up more dirt than those people, and they have pictures too.
Gut. Take 18.
Ich kannte ein sein Girl, besser gesagt, sie kannte mich. Sie zeigte ihr Haus und war sehr stolz, alles war Holz. Sie bat mich zu bleiben und sprach, setz dich irgendwo hin. Ich sah mich um und ich stellte fest, kein Stuhl war drin. Ich trank ihren Wein und setzte mich auf den Teppich. Wir sprachen bis zwei, dann sprach die Maid, ist Schlafenszeit. Sie sagte, sie muss früh zur Arbeit und lächelte nett. Ich suchte und fand in der Steinbadewanne ein Bett. Aufgewacht, flog es schon fort, das Vöglein dort. So machte ich Feuer und war sehr stolz, alles war Holz.
To the flower power. A trivial portion of our population, I'm happy to note. If you're attempting to put on the whole world, forget it. Many of the world governments have no sense of humor at all, and ours is getting a little thin. If you're deriving your philosophy from drugs, remember that sooner or later playtime ends and it's time for show and tell. If you're really sincere, then why not find your own Shangri-La, set up shop, and stop attempting to convert the millions of responsible Americans that have already found theirs. To rebel against tyranny is commendable. To rebel against freedom in any form is asinine. As long as you do not keep me from my barber, I have no quarrel with your long hair or beards. As long as I'm not required to spend any time in an enclosed area with you, the same goes for your body hygiene. You profess to believe in free love when it's in private with two consenting adults. Isn't that your kind of bag? However, the freedom you so vigorously seek by your demonstration, that of enjoying the benefits of this country's advantages while refusing to take part in strengthening its structure, is selfish pusillanimity. Make love, not war, you say. From where a lot of people your age are sitting, it doesn't appear that the North Vietnamese want to kiss them. You attempt to imply that people in America like war. I'm forced to admit there are a handful of people in this country that do enjoy wars, but they're a bigger bunch of nuts than you are. I must admit your make love, not war, does bring a sick, humorous thought to mind. If everyone in the world could be convinced, when two countries disagreed on anything, they could have a love-in. A panel of impartial judges could select the winner. If you ever should, heaven forbid, convince the majority of this country to practice your policy of make love, not war, it would be only a matter of time before the communists would be telling you to make all the love you want right after a 10-hour gig in the salt mine. You refuse to face up to reality that life consists of a little more give than take. If you refuse to contribute anything more to our society than your blooming philosophy, consider this. There must be an uncharted island somewhere, covered with flowers and void of soap and razors. So please, be my guest.
We saw how the secret police was unsuccessful in stemming the tide, how the Hungarian army refused to support the old regime, and how the Soviet leaders and the Hungarian Stalinist Moscovite turned to the last resort, to the help of the Soviet army, to keep the Stalinist in power in Hungary. We also saw how, in the early morning hours of October 24th, the Soviet tanks, artillery troops, tank divisions moved into Budapest and launched their terror attack with the hope that the great amount of Soviet tanks, the overwhelming power of Russian divisions, will terrorize the town and re-establish a pacific situation and the authority of the totalitarian regime. Now that was again a great surprise to the Soviet leaders and for the Hungarian Stalinists that things turn out in a very different way. The more Soviet tanks appeared, the more Soviet terror was carried out, the broader the resistance were. Now here a series of questions arose. First of all, how was it possible that one of the most professional, most well-trained and organized conventional army in Europe, the Soviet army, when it invaded the capital city of Hungary, Budapest, that young people in their teens and early 20s were capable to resist that highly professional army, this highly efficient army, this army which after all was one of the main means in defeat of Hitler's war machine. That was a kind of puzzle to many at the time and even since for some military historians. Where did these young people take their, so to say, military professional knowledge to fight the Soviet tanks, artillery, and infantry? Well, of course, again, we have to return to the basic nature of the fighting capacity of a man in uniform. Of course, this is primarily morale and psychology. These people wanted to fight. The people wanted to fight for their freedom. They wanted to fight against the aggressors, which they believed were absolutely unwarranted, unjustified. So that the will to protect their hoped-for freedom was there. But that is not enough in a modern battle like the Battle of Budapest, which raged from October 24th to late October 28th. There was, as a matter of fact, indeed a professional knowledge present. How come? The totalitarian regime in Hungary, under Soviet direction, of course, introduced the broadest compulsory military training in Hungary which ever occurred in Hungary's history. High school students, both boys and girls, were exposed to military training. No one could receive a college or university degree without a substantial military training. To be an ROTC member is a matter of voluntary choice in the United States, for example. It was not a matter of choice for university students. All the able-bodied university students were exposed willingly or unwillingly for a very substantial military training in the universities and colleges. Something more. Of course, this military training was for conventional military force, for different commissioned positions in a conventional army. But the Soviet Union believed that communism and Communist Party, as such, was the strongest in Hungary among all of the East Central European nations. Why did the Soviet Union believe that? It was simple, because the party membership in Hungary was the highest, proportionately speaking, among all the communist-controlled countries of East Central Europe. Hungary had in 1956 a little bit more than 10 million population, and the Communist Party membership was well over a million. More, about 11% of the population were Communist Party members. And if you disregard the very old and the very young and take into account the adult male population of the country, practically the utmost majority of the adult working male population in Hungary were members of the Communist Party. That the Soviet regime and the Stalinist leaders in Hungary took at face value as a proof that Hungary became a communist nation, a term so easily used as far as these East Central European countries are concerned. Now that was again a very, very tragic for the communist miscalculation. These people joined the party because there was no way out to have a secure job. They joined the Communist Party to be emancipated from permanent harassment. They joined the Communist Party as an excuse not to go out, not to stand, not to become political activists, not to be obliged day after day to prove their loyalty toward the Soviet Union or toward the communist regime. Because of this false evaluation, because of the false belief in Moscow and in the Hungarian communist leadership that Hungary was already turned into a communist nation, they believed that Hungary was not only ready to equip, to organize and to man a large conventional army. But the Soviet believed that the Hungarian people's adherence of communism make the whole nation a potential fighter nation in defense of communism if ever a war will break out. Therefore, many Soviet advisors were sent to Hungary to train the young people not only just as conventional fighters, but as partisan fighters. Soviet experts in partisan warfare, and as a matter of fact, during World War II, the Soviet collected substantial experiment in successful guerrilla fight against the Nazis. These experts were sent to Hungary and started to train high school students, boys and girls, college students, university students, to be leaders and effectual fighters in guerrilla units. By other words, the Soviet Union trained in Hungary its most ferocious opponents. These students then, when the Hungarian reform movement was turned into a bloody revolution, used the knowledge gained from the Soviet against the Soviet. That is then the answer and explanation of the puzzle. How come that these young people were so effective street fighters, one of the most difficult forms of battle? The second question is, where from they took the army, the armament, ammunition, etc. Here again, there were certain indications that the 1st Regiment, which appeared in front of the radio building on October the 23rd, at the time of sunset, a considerable part of this regiment offered their army arms to the youth. There was another indication that the very first weapons of the demonstrators were taken away from the secret police reinforcement. But all of these would not have been enough for such a long battle in Budapest, for a nationwide fight, which, as a matter of fact, since the intervention of the Soviet Union, was not just a revolution. It became a war of national independence against the aggression of a foreign great power, the Soviet Red Army. Where from then the other arms came? There were now two basic sources. One was from the existing armed forces. And the existing armed forces in any Soviet-dominated country are the army itself, secret police regiments, and police forces. All the barracks of army, secret police, or police were huge stores of light and middle-sized armament. Many of these regiments, many of these police posts opened their doors and supplied newly created freedom fighter forces their own weapon and equipped them. So that from the existing armed forces, armament and ammunition poured into the new freedom fighter forces freely. But there was another source of armament. In Hungary, like in all the other Soviet-controlled countries, the Soviet Union built up a huge armament industrial base. In Hungary, all kind of armament, up to mortars, guns, tanks, were produced by the factories. Now the laborers joined the freedom fighters. Truckloads of guns and ammunition poured into Budapest from the industrial zone south and northeast of the city. So the laborers poured as much armaments and ammunition into the new freedom fighter organization as they needed. There was no problem at all as far as armament and ammunition was concerned. The battle against the Soviet aggressors could be fed by ammunition and arms from stores. Now, the third major question is that if this revolution was a spontaneous outbreak of longing for freedom, how could again small spontaneous groups fight against the very professional Soviet army for 5 days? Was not there a clandestine underground headquarters of the freedom fighters set up much before the revolution? Was the whole freedom fight not organized weeks, months, perhaps years before it broke out? And a underground headquarters, was not such an organization in existence much before? After all, during World War II, we saw several such examples. One of the best was the Polish Home Army, which fought against the Nazis and was organized and maintained effective underground headquarters for years before the real armed fight broke out. Well, the answer is no. There was no organized underground headquarters whatsoever before the revolution, and even the first fighting days of this 5 days Battle of Budapest were fought without any central headquarters of the freedom fighter forces. As a matter of fact, it is an exemplary historical phenomenon that such a huge freedom fighter force as it existed during this 5 days Battle of Budapest fought without an effective central headquarters. It is an exemplary historical phenomenon that a huge force was directed, led, the fought was fight was conducted not by a military headquarters but by an idea, the community of idea. The belief of the justness of their ideas was so terrifically strong that that was enough to lead them. But of course, gradually, the high spirit would not have been enough. The community of ideas would not have been enough. The maintenance of the pressure against the Russians would not have been possibly effective enough without central headquarters of the freedom fighters. So gradually these small and large groups organized around a brave man, around a man which the other trusted, around a man who had certain know-how of organization. The spontaneous group, as the battle raged, gradually felt that they will be more successful and really they would be able to stabilize and consolidate their gains if they organize a central headquarters which then will coordinate, consolidate and harmonize the future activities of these guerrilla groups. So that different freedom fighter posts, strongholds, units, after organizing themselves into a really military effective unit, began to contact neighboring similar groups, began to suggest to each other, why don't we send out representatives somehow, somewhere, to discuss how to coordinate and consolidate our work. And that movement to seek for a central headquarters spread all around Budapest. And from Budapest, the capital city, that movement started to spread around the country. So that in October 26 and 27, an underground meeting was held in the former headquarters of the police commander of Budapest, in which army units represented themselves, freedom fighter units represented themselves, worker organization, trade union organization represented themselves. It is again almost a mystery of the revolution, how the word spread so fast that such a meeting is held, and how the enemy did not find out that such a meeting was going ahead. That again showed the terrific loyalty of the freedom fighters to each other. Now gradually this whole meeting climaxed on October 27 in that building of the former headquarters of the police commander of Budapest. This meeting then passed several resolutions. First of all, it passed the resolution that all the freedom fighter forces will be united into the new armed force of the emerging Democratic Hungary, and they passed the resolution that the name of this new armed force will be the National Guard of Hungary. They selected this name because it had a very good sounding in Hungarian ears. This term, National Guard of Hungary, was used at the first time in the 1848 revolution about which we already talked. In this revolution and freedom fight during which Louis Kossuth, the president of the First Hungarian Republic, organized this armed force, National Guard in Hungary, which defeated the Habsburg forces. And in return, it was defeated by a massive Russian aggression in 1849. So that even a gallant stand against Russian aggressors was among those concepts which was covered, which was represented by the name National Guard of Hungary. So a resolution was now passed that a new National Guard of Hungary will be created by the unification of all the fighting forces, including those army units which joined the revolution. Well, a resolution is a resolution, words, written or oral. It means anything if some teeth are put into them. The resolution had to be carried out. And now, for the realization of this resolution, this mass meeting decided to select persons who will set up the National Guard of Hungary. First of all, a committee was elected from men whom the freedom fighter trusted. The committee, the full name of which was the Revolutionary Council for National Defense.
There's an old story that says you can't kill a frog by dropping him in boiling water. He reacts so quickly to the sudden heat that he jumps out before he's hurt. But if you put him in cold water and then warm it up gradually, he never decides to jump until it's too late. By then, he's cooked. Men are just as foolish. Take away their freedom overnight and you've got a violent revolution. But steal it from them gradually, under the guise of security, peace, or progress, and you can paralyze an entire generation. Look at the income tax. It started out at a harmless sounding 1%. It would have been easy to jump out of water as tepid as this. But like the frog, we waited while it climbed ever higher. Try jumping now. And worst of all, we never learn. Even today, we cannot believe that Medicare is the same warm water that will one day boil us in socialized medicine. We see no connection between farm price supports and nationalized agriculture. But if we draw a parallel between subsidized teachers' pay and federal control of education, we are called extremists. The tragedies of history are always repeated by those who refuse to learn them. To seek guidance from the past is not turning the clock back, as we're often told. It is merely a good way to keep out of hot water.
The Navigators. Between us on our wide bed, we cuddle an incubus whom we have filled with voyages. We wake more apart than before, with open hands. Your stomach and my head begin to ache. We cannot work. You are in pain. I cry. Outside the dirty window in the damp film of new spring, muddy brown children dabble cardboard in puddles, chalk across a wall where two boys on a fire escape eat oranges. Love, longing makes us both anonymous, middle-aged, quarrelsome, ridiculous. You hurt for want of tears. I cry for pain. Real, grimy, and exiled, he eludes us. I would show him books and bridges and make a language we could all speak. No blonde fantasy mother has sent to plague us in the spring. He has his own bad dreams, needs work, gets drunk, maybe would not have chosen to be beautiful. Because we held him while he screamed or threw up, were good in bed or good for a hot meal, we were not given his life by the scruff of its neck or even the right to speak too much out of turn. Love, my love, is not what you have done, but what you are just now doing. Oh, I would hold his head and feed him oranges to taste his warm home, pink shrimp to taste the green lick of the sea, to taste the road, tart, cold, wild apples and long, pale grapes with dusty moon skins, to taste my love, amber Greek honey that coats his tongue with sweet thinking of bitter, to taste my love, raw meat, radishes, lemons, and salt rubbing his lips where they are broken. I spread his calloused hand like a closed plant. machines and ropes ripped scars across his palm, leaving it tough and skillful. Watching him wake or read or take my camera apart, I learn what learning is and how the eye reverses image into memory. Have I learned his face in this much time, grotesque with concentration, creased with sleep, the fear that grays his eyes at a knocked door, the angle of his chin when he is lying? Levi'd blonde and grease-stained, the American dream cannot love the Jew's devious daughter. He shrugs her spells off adolescent shoulders. She cannot witch him with her ancient language or scraps of denim sleeve under her pillow or comb his name in her long hair with ivory. He never knows whose son he is, and she would not be other than her mother's daughter. Still, for a short while, we shed our myths like spring skins and sat across a table over dark wood laboriously translated till we, precarious, unique, and human with naked hands and eyes, spoke to each other, and something freer than necessity tangled our arms and backs, merged our blue mornings. You made an algebra, his tastes in food, when the dinner guests would be too much for him to keep his poise, his surly moods, to calculate how often you could touch the real boy like your dream sharing our bed, one arm sprawled off the mattress near your head. He slept, your hands relaxed around his chest, and all the ambiguities could rest between your shoulder and his shoulder blades. I saw you move your mouth against his nape, wanting to wake him in your arms, afraid of how his face would age coming awake. His wife at Bellevue. Trackless and lost between piss-colored walls, she huddles on the bench arm, hides her face, shakes with sobs or dry retching. The intern calls names in a bored voice. People shift in place. Clocks sweep toward morning and she hides her face. Between the red felt collar and her hair, her neck is cracked with white beneath the brown. I draw an old man. Three boys turn to stare over their bench to see what I have down. One has a bloody gash beneath his hair. I am a stranger whom she cannot trust. She hid her face and let me bring her here. My hand quiets her trembling. Since she must feel some hand on her sickness and her fear, my hand is on her shoulder. We are here. Across the mud flats and the wide roads, over rivers and borders, by bus, truck, trailer, car, and foot, my two loves have gone, the dark and the fair. Truck drivers, salesmen, schoolgirls on vacation taste the salt fruit of their bodies. They breathe strange air, strange hands press their shoulders, strange voices speak to them. Mother of exiles, save them from wind and rage. Mother of journeys, let the sea be kind to them. Along the highway, despair and dead animals steam on the macadam. Sheet white, the sky closes them in. Miles apart in a mud-wide state, they sing out loud, and the long road is empty from red hill to scrub bush. Branches are bare with heat, and it's only May. Home and the port swing like a compass needle, both far away. Mother of exiles, save them from wind and rage. Mother of journeys, let the sea be kind to them. Together, briefly, they sit on splintered pilings. Thick, spit-yellow foam slaps the diesel hulls. Storms are in the gulf. The catch is north. North on an old coast, landlocked on my island, dry and soot-thick summer, I spin their warmth. I loop their names in words. One road is closed to women and conspirators. I plot. I sing. Mother of exiles, save them from wind and rage. Mother of journeys, let the sea be kind to them. When you told me that he was in jail again, I scrounged 200 for his bail in 2 hours, wired it down, came home, threw up, cried while you brewed me coffee, and threw up every 30 minutes flat for 2 days, till the airline ended that and flew him back. Pale, tired, clean, I took the carry bus at 2:15 and waited at the terminal for him. He had new checked pegged slacks. They'd cropped his hair. He said he was surprised that I was there and had I dieted to get so thin. He asked why you weren't there, and I said, well, you were engaging in diplomacy and would be waiting up at the hotel, which meant you had to wait around and see his wife. We took the bus back. It was dark inside, but floodlit girders looped the park. Grained heavy cones of light spilled on the sky as planes dropped to their runways through the mist. There was a groan of engines as we kissed, and searchlights limned my hand over his thigh. 72nd Street, so tired it hurt. The florid Slav, bursting his dirty shirt, could see from the cash window what we were, a trio of unluggaged travelers wanting cheap beds and anonymity. You signed for two, although he could see three. Two bull dykes teased an acrid teenage whore pinioned with dexies to the lobby door and wondered if distinction could be made among us who was trick and who was trade. The walls were hotel green. Someone had drawn blue crayon mountains facing the iron bed. We shelved our change of underwear. I yawned. A swish of cars, a whiff of the dried dead came through the blinded courtyard to the halls. You went away that night. The tangled sheets were heaped and ribboned underneath our feet. I held him combed in foreign sounds. Thin walls enclosed nocturnal lexicons. He dreamed of walls, baked concrete glaring at the sun. Thick sewage sucked his chest. A milky gleam slid on the trustee's buttons, and the gun barrel cocked on his hip swelled twice its size. I ground my fists in pillows, reading him. He threw his hands up to protect his eyes and woke, knocking his elbow on my chin. Bailed out too soon, back in our den of exiles, he dreams of ships and speaks to us in code. He hides his golden back from the June sun, learns music from you, teaches me prisoners' games, reads novels about glorious escapes. Freedom is fugue and love is a disease, the way they teach blonde boys in Gulfport towns. He is too sullen and too beautiful. Deafened by music and his longing silence, my mouth and hands no longer speak for me. Writing, my fingers brush and rub on him. Talking, my tongue hits salt and tastes him. Then, where he was, an empty space and dreams, the clean sea and his naked body, gold in a spray of sun, round hard arms, sweat-oiled, reaching to fold me in. Between his hands, I wake, we, loving him, new strangers, wake. A knot of journeys underneath my ribs bursts like coming when an oilboat prow slices the river night southward to sea, while humpback tugs chug north with open doors between the hawsepipe flushing and the stalk where two lights flash for barges. I will go north on the coastal shuttle to the Keys, or southwest over the border across the mesas down the devious flanks of red clay mountains to the plaza lights of another city. Amidst these exiles, I on my own ground am exiled. I know the joy of journeys, drowsing through dawn on a humming bus rushing northeast, someone asleep on my shoulder, woke with the palms of leaves pressed on the windows in a coastal forest smelling the sea, crossed foreign mountains in a stranger's car, fleeing the unbelievable police on the same ocean thousands of miles south. Distance is sometimes bitter in my mouth, but always spiced with something to be sought or seen ahead, the sea again, the green of ancient stone, old trees on a new sky, the gaslight of a plaza, Spanish tile chilling my bare feet, spiced tripe on my tongue with onions in the morning. This round exuberance could conquer art. The air spins with adventures, and I spring on my new body, letting them reach me and catching open-handed. Air recoils beneath my soles. Blue skies, scarred concrete, or walls to bounce off, grips to stretch and reach. I hit the ground like live waves on a beach. My old city sinks to river winter. Immobile and alone, I learn to lie at desks, drink brandy, know my age, digest somebody's overwritten page, and love can't turn my stomach anymore. I vomited some bile and I survive, with guts gone rational to stay alive. Say if my hands are fit for making charts that have been idle in their older arts. Winter and age, we three are in our harbors trying to make a basin of the sea to bathe our hands together in, all three sharing water over depths and miles and losing touch in distance, speech and style. Orpheus and Animus drawing back to journeys now, leaving me on shores behind streets and shutters of the mind as a new October streaks dry hollows underneath our cheeks. All that I have learned from you, All that I have failed to learn, I will order up again with an overcautious pen, making models, giving names. Nothing ever stays the same. Initiate the change that moves the peripheries of love.
To philosophize is to learn how to die. That's how to live. To philosophize is to learn how to die. That's how to live. How to live. To learn how to die. That's how to live. To philosophize is to learn how to die. Learn how to die. That's how to live. To philosophize is to learn how to die. Learn how to die. That's how to live. That's how to live. To philosophize is to learn how to die.
That's how to live. That's how to live. How to live.
To philosophize is to learn how to die.
That's how to live. How to live.
To learn how to die.
That's how to live.
The question how to live
is to learn how to die.
The question how to live has become the question how to love. The question how to live, how to live, has become the question how to love. How to love. The question how to live, has become the question
of how to love. How to live,
how to love,
has become the question how to love.
Love is not just as strong as death, it is stronger. Love is not just as strong as death, it is stronger. It is stronger. The question how to live. Love the question dares the self to leave itself behind.
The question how to love.
The question how to live. Love dares the self to leave itself behind.
How to love.
The question how to live. How
to live
and hacks become a way at the self to make a space that's large enough for love to enter.
Love is not just as strong as death,
and hatch a way at the self to make a space
away at the self
that's large enough for love to enter.
Love is not just as strong as death, it is stronger.
Love is not just as strong as death, it is stronger.
Association.
Love is not just as strong as
association,
it is stronger.
Human beings.
Love is not just as strong as death,
human beings.
It is stronger. An association of free human beings.
Janis Joplin. Crying from exile, I mourn you, dead singer, crooning and palming your cold cheeks, calling you, you. A man told me you died. He was foreign, I felt, for the first time, drunk in his car, my throat choked. You won't sing for me now. Later, I laughed in the hair between his shoulder blades, well enough loved in a narrow bed. It was your southern comfort grin stretching my mouth. You were in me all night, shouting our pain, sucking off the mic, telling a strong...
Amsel singt die Nacht des Toten still. Hebt die Flügel hoch und lernt den Flug, wenn sie will. Und du willst nur warten auf den Aufstieg lang genug. Amsel singt die Nacht des Toten still. Hebt die Augen hoch und lernt zu sehen, wenn sie will. Und du willst nur warten auf den Tag, so frei zu stehen. Amsel, flieh. Amsel, flieh. Unter dem Licht, das dem Dunkel bricht. Musik.
Yeah, good afternoon. You're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com on the net. And that was, of course, the sixth Beatle, Klaus Beyer. Klaus Beyer sings the Beatles in his inimitable way. That was his version in German of Blackbird. Before that, I had to slightly censor myself before the poem became too explicit. At this time of day, we're not allowed to broadcast that stuff. So that was the poetry and voice of Marilyn Hacker, and that was an elegy for Janis Joplin, which I had to quickly remove from the turntable. Before that, there was a much longer track by the same poet, Marilyn, the poetry and voice of Marilyn Hacker, The Navigators. That was the long 12-minute track. We've had Klaus Beyer. We've had Simon Critchley, Long After Tonight Is All Over. And before that, we had The Hungarian Revolution, narrated by the Commander-in-Chief of the Freedom Fighter Forces, Major General Bela K. Kirali, in an excerpt from the United Nations report of the Special Committee on the Problem of Hungary, recorded, I think, in 1969. And, of course, what should we call him? He sounds like he would probably be a Donald Trump supporter. This is from an album called An Open Letter by Victor Lundberg. And I shall play one more track of his, which is An Open Letter to My Teenage Son.
Dear son, you ask my reaction to long hair or beards on young people. Some great men have worn long hair and beards, George Washington and Abraham Lincoln. If to you long hair or a beard is a symbol of independence, if you believe in your heart that the principles of this country, our heritage, is worthy of this display of pride that all men shall remain free, that free men at all times will not inflict their personal limitations of achievement on others, to demand your own rights as well as the rights of others and be willing to fight for this right, you have my blessing. You ask that I not judge you merely as a teenager, to judge you on your own personal habits, abilities, and goals. This is a fair request, and I promise I will not judge any person only as a teenager, if you will constantly remind yourself that some of my generation judges people by their race, their belief, or the color of their skin, and that this is no more right than saying all teenagers are drunken dope addicts or glue sniffers. If you will judge every human being on his own individual potential, I will do the same. You ask me if God is dead. This is a question each individual must answer within himself. Could a warm summer day, with all its brightness, all its sound, all its exhilarating breathiness, just happen? God is love, Remember that God is a guide and not a stormtrooper. Realize that many of the past and present generation, because of a well-intentioned but unjustifiable misconception, have attempted to legislate morality. This created part of the basis for your generation's need to rebel against our society. With this knowledge, perhaps your children will never ask, is God dead? I sometimes think much of mankind is attempting to work him to death. You ask my opinion of draft card burners. I would answer this way. All past wars have been dirty, unfair, immoral, bloody, and second-guessed. However, history has shown most of them necessary. If you doubt that our free enterprise system in the United States is worth protecting, if you doubt the principles upon which this country was founded, that we remain free to choose our religion, our individual endeavors, our method of government, if you doubt that each free individual in this great country should reap rewards commensurate only with his own efforts, then it's doubtful you belong here. If you doubt that people to govern us should be selected by their desire to allow us to strive for any goal we feel capable of attaining, then it's doubtful you should participate in their selection. If you are not grateful to a country that gave your father the opportunity to work for his family, to give you the things you've had, and you do not feel pride enough to fight for your right to continue in this manner, then I assume the blame for your failure to recognize the true value of our birthright. Now, I would remind you that your mother will love you no matter what you do, because she is a woman. And I love you too, son. But I also love our country and the principles for which we stand. And if you decide to burn your draft card, then burn your birth certificate at the same time. From that moment on, I have no son.
Oh,